Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. I'm really excited to share this episode with the wonderful Lauren Groff. But firstly, if you're listening to this on October 23rd, this is the last week to buy my latest novel, Limelight, as a 99p Kindle mega deal. Christmas is coming. You can order a signed copy of Limelight or any of my books, including Insatiable, Careering, The Sisterhood and How to Be a Grown-Up from the Margate Bookshop. They deliver all across the UK. Listeners in the US can buy the brand new edition of How to Be a Grown-Up, which is published by Urano. It's also the last week to sign up for my writing course, Write Like a Reader. At the time of recording, there are still a couple of places available. And if you'd like to talk more about reading, writing and your own creative work, you'll want my Substack, creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com, or you can email creativeconfidenceclinic@gmail.com. I'd love to see you there. You can join me for conversations about books, craft talk and cheerleading. Now to Lauren Groff. Lauren is a novelist and short story writer whose work is hugely acclaimed. She has been garlanded with awards. She's a frequent national book finalist and her fans include Stephen King, Britt Bennett, Marion Keyes and, for what it's worth, me. We're celebrating her astonishing new book, The Vaster Wilds. Lauren is a writer's reader. She describes reading as her main job. We talked about sexy books, precocious reading and the ultimate creative meditation. Huge thanks to Waterstones Gower Street for letting us record the episode in your lovely shop. You might be able to hear a bit of London traffic rumbling by. So, this is a question that puts you on the spot a bit, because one of the things I really loved about The Vaster Wilds is, in spite of everything, I think there are cosy passages when fish are caught and when shelter is built. As a reader, I found that so warming and so satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there are any books that make you feel that way, whether they're books where that's happening kind of amidst panic and violence and drama, or if it's a more general kind of Little House in the Big Woods vibe.
Oh, well, there are a lot of books that more generally have those cozy vibes for me. The one that came to mind when you said in the midst of the drama is actually weirdly War and Peace, that moment in the midst of battle when I think it's Prince Alexei falls down. He's struck or something. He falls down and he's looking up and there are bullets whizzing by and he just sort of sees the clouds. There's this beautiful moment of just rest and peace and understanding what it means to be alive in this time, and he's not quite sure if he's still alive. So there's that incredible passage. But a book that I will go to for a larger understanding of just comfort is Middlemarch by George Eliot. There's something about the golden honeyed nature of her wisdom that just you just live within it for the however many hundreds of pages that it takes to read Middlemarch, and then, you know, you're reborn into like greater wisdom and calm somehow.
I've never read it, for shame. I think because I've been so daunted by it. But how did you meet it? When did you first read it? Did someone recommend it to you?
Oh my gosh! So my mother was never a giant reader when I was a child. She loves books, but she works really hard, and she's the sort of person who I think she may have a little bit of ADHD, because she, when she's given an option, she will have a project. She will paint a windowsill, right? And so at one point when it became clear that I was a giant reader and 10, 11, 12 years old, she went to her shelf where she had all of the books from college, and she pulled down Middlemarch and she gave it to me. And so I do associate Middlemarch with my mother, and I actually didn't remember that moment until now. But yeah, I got it from her.
Oh, that's really lovely. Yeah. And she read it. Was it a book that she'd enjoy?
Oh, she loved it. Yeah. She saw me reading, I think it was Jane Austen at the time. She said, oh, if that interests you, you know, I know of another incredible English woman writer that you might want to read.
Oh, and that feeling as well at that age where an enormous book isn't a scary challenge. You think, yes, bang for my buck.
Right, exactly. No, and you feel so smart reading it. In fourth grade, I read Gone with the Wind, which I know is a piece of tripe, but at the time, it was the biggest book I ever attempted, and it was something like 1,000 pages, and I felt very proud of myself for finishing it. So I was, you know, an egotistical reader even then.
Well, I feel as though Gone with the Wind is rarely mentioned as part of that classic canon. And I think it absolutely is, because it shaped the imagination of so many writers, and it's so full of these big emotions and big themes. And I think people are a little embarrassed by it. But
would they be embarrassed about it if it had been written by a dude? So I think they would be, though, because it is a little bit embarrassing. Right? I mean, there are a lot of moments in that book that in the 21st century do not seem okay. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think we have a lot of literary snobbery and a lot of shame in America about our literary heritage because it's very short. So I think this book, because it has a love story at the center, because it's so sexy, because of Clark Gable and Vivien Leigh, it became something other than I think maybe you're right. Maybe in another 150 years, we'll look back without the shame and maybe see the effects of the book on the world. Maybe that's what we want to pay attention to.
Is that love story what you were responding to when you're in fourth grade? Had you seen the movie?
I had not seen the movie. No, I didn't know anything about the book except that it was set during the Civil War. And it really really stirred my imagination, right? In fourth grade, you're just a baby. You don't understand anything about humans or like the human nature. And so coming across Scarlett, who's this larger than life personality, right? She's bold. She's mean. She does terrible things, right? She's actually a very good heroine. And suddenly I saw this person in this society where she was supposed to be kept docile because Southern women do not speak out. And having this large grandiosity was really kind of amazing. It kind of blew my mind. And then the love story, of course, was also deeply compelling for my fourth grade mind.
I think a lot about those big love stories we respond to, and things like you know, stories like Jane Eyre, and even, you know, in Jane Austen, where, as I think, you know, young, smart girls and women, we gravitate to those stories. Mm-hmm. And it takes, I mean, to be honest, it's taken me decades with a lot of those. So hold on a minute. That was a toxic, horrible, right. That was a bad man, and marriage was simply
is
the only viable economic proposition.
It
wasn't a love match at all.
No. Absolutely. No, it was horrible. But, you know, of course, we're grown and raised in a web of understanding that it takes a very long time to sort of make our way out of. So I'm proud of us for having gotten that far, right?
Absolutely. And even when in real life it was very difficult to marry for love, that women still wrote about that and yearned for it. I think that's really exciting.
And
it's kind of using writing to kind of heal and or escape, I guess.
I love that take that love matches are a sign of female autonomy. That's really beautiful. That's a smart way to put it.
I love this image of you as the reader in your family and the sort of proper book addict. When did that take hold? Can you remember the first book you read on your own and you thought, this is it, this is me?
So I have an older brother who's only 16 months older than I am, and he is the sort of person who will suck all the air out of every room that you have ever been in. He's very loud, he's very opinionated. When he speaks, somebody else speaks. So I took to books really early as a way of just being able to control my world and to be able to sit apart and probably deal with my anxiety. So I was a reader from, I think, 4 years old. The first book I read was a Little Bear book. I don't know if you have these here. They're these beautiful, I want to say either early 20th century or late 19th century, line drawing books with Little Bear and his friends. And there's this one moment where I remember reading carrots, potatoes, peas, and tomatoes. And I read the words, and that was the first time I actually had that shock of recognition that the words that I had memorized are actually the words on the page. So it was pretty early for me just because I wanted to escape family dynamics.
I love that it's understanding a secret code, isn't it? Those memories of just figuring it out. And when you realize as well, and it's not just this book. It's all of them.
It's all of them. You have the secret code. Yeah. No, it's so mysterious and wonderful. Especially, so I'm from a very tiny town of under 2,000 people. Suddenly, I had the entire world opened up, right? It's like the library was a portal to Narnia, right? It was really the most extraordinary thing that can happen to a child is getting literacy and being allowed to just discover whatever books you wanted to discover. And I read voraciously. I read in a Catholic manner, everything I could come across, right? Things that were not appropriate in any way.
And what would surprise us in that list? I'd love to hear about the weird things that popped up.
I think I probably have talked about this before, but I was deeply into Clan of the Cave Bears. Really, way too early.
These books have come up on the podcast before. Am I right in thinking they're they're quite erotic?
Oh, they're massively erotic, but it's caveman sex. So it's so weird, right? And it's, yes, it was the first understanding I had of any kind of sexual anything. And it was like really brutal and horrible. And that's what I thought it, this activity that people did was, right? Because of these books. My dad saw me rereading Clan of the Cave Bears, didn't know what was in it. And he went out and bought me the second book in the series, which was very conflicted. Conflicted when I read the book because I was really grateful to him, but also like, ooh, this is really gross. My dad gave it to me. And I was having a really hard moment with that book. That was a very strange book that I picked off my parents' shelves. I also picked up a bunch of Philip Roth when I was really young. And he is unstinting when it comes to sex, for sure. There was this Aesop's Fables that was drawn by a very famous 1960s line artist, but he put like the genitals very squarely in the center of the book. And I remember reading it almost like trying to figure out what these things are on the page. Very young, like 5 or 6 years old. So there were a lot of books that my parents just let us read because, you know, I think they did the right thing. I mean, I think they gave us enough of a understanding to come to them if we were confused, and then they trusted us to have our own like ability to deal with the things that we read.
I think as well, the number of times when I go back and read something that I read for the first time when I was very young, I thought, I do not remember this at all.
No, it's true.
But then I reread Bonjour Tristesse a couple of years ago.
Yes, I just reread that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like about a month ago. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Because I was going to say, I remember loving it so much. Yeah. I think I would have been about 12 or 13 and very much the right age for it. And in my memory, there was loads of sex. And on this reread, I was like, where did the sex go?
Right. It was almost not there, not on the page at all. No, you're right. It was more of an erotic book than like a sexual book, for sure. Yeah. And it's very small, too. It's really short.
In the edition I read, there was another one of her stories with it, which I don't think I had read before. And I don't think a lot really happens. It's just a young woman and an older man. But there's an amazing line I love where she's really grumpy and they're staying in a hotel somewhere fabulous in the south of France. And it's all got a bit of a sort of like Godardy feel to it. And she says something like, you know, clearly you're in a terrible mood and there's nothing that will help you beyond luxury and alcohol. I am in that mood. So.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful.
When do you read? Are you, it sounds like you're someone who still has a reading habit and that's what you do when you need to be with a book. But Have you ever found it difficult to make time for it? Have you always
read? No, I don't have another job. This is my only job. So reading is my first job and then writing is my second one. So I read every day, all day long. If I'm going for a run, I'm listening to an audiobook. Unless I have to think through something in the work itself, and then I listen to my own labored breath. If I can't work well in the morning when I get up and go up to work, I will read, because that's also part of writing. And I read before bed as well, because screens make me insane and I can't sleep if I have a screen like 4 hours before bed. So I'm genuinely reading all the time. I read about 300 books a year, something around there.
I do think that is such an important part of writing, mm-hmm. and I always want to talk about it. You cannot begin to write unless you know
it's
read
so
everything
true.
And like
so
read
true.
Great books and you yeah. know and read bad books, read the sort of the high quality serious things.
Yes.
Also read Gone with the Wind or the 2023 version of Gone with the Wind, because we need that.
We do, absolutely. Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that it's just a random figure, but I do think about 1,000 books go into writing a single book, right? You have to have read a lot. So you have to have built up that foundation of understanding how to tell a story, all of the many options that you have, right? And I guess to see into other people's minds the way that books allow you to see into other people's minds enough. So before you can actually set out and write the beautiful book that is lurking in you, I 100% agree.
Do you know a book, it's an English book, an English writer, and it's sort of early 20th century, possibly a little bit earlier than that, Diary of a Provincial Lady by E.M. Delafield?
No, I don't.
It's super fun. It's like Bridget Jones, but sort of 100 years ago. And it's just very, 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 very funny. Diary entries.
I cannot wait.
They will have it here. She's a kind of, I suppose, a upperish middle class woman, who she's a writer, mm-hmm. and I think it's sort of fairly autobiographical, but it's sort of the managing the household and the grumpy husband, and she's got a cook that she's always having a fight with. But when I read that, and I think I tried to read it when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. and I didn't really feel it, or I didn't really get it, mm-hmm. and I came back and read it quite recently, and mm-hmm. there are lots of books up until wartime, mm-hmm. which is really lovely and really felt weirdly for a war. It is great fun, but suddenly I had that moment of, you know, being catapulted through space and time, thinking, oh, all these authors I love, the references are there, and the language and the rhythm and even the lines, like, of course. It was this sort of fabulous joining of the dots.
I love that. No, it's so true, right? I mean, we're all joining a chorus that's already been sung for thousands of years, right? We're not soloists. Yeah,
and I think that's so comforting as well, yeah. when we're writing. And I don't know, because I think all of your novels are so fiercely original and so sort of independent, but I don't know if you've ever had that fear of like, has this been done? And should I do it?
Well, I mean, you know this because probably you do this too. You put little homages into all of your books, right? There are little moments that you say, I'm intentionally layering in. In Vester Wilds, for instance, it was Cormac McCarthy or Robinson Crusoe or Proust, even. There was a moment, there was a Proustian moment that I sort of layered into the book as well. And you do it out of love, because you want those voices echoing in your work as well, right? I think I'd be more afraid of those homages, those voices not being in the work than thinking of that I've worrying that I'm writing something that's already been written.
Oh, that's a really, really beautiful way to put it. And I love that idea of these voices being our guides and our mentors, and
yeah.
be able to go back, and it's a sort of a tribute and a thank you as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And also I think for readers, there's something really magical, I think. And what I love so much about doing this podcast is when I meet, you know, incredible authors, and then we're both the fans of the same book. Mm. And it's so intimate, and it's so leveling, and it feels so kind of democratic. And I think that's it as well. As a writer, when you're reaching out to your reader and your reader recognizes it, we're like, hey, we're on the same team here. It's got that feeling of being together on the page.
Well, it's so democratic, right? I think that it's probably the most democratic art there is, because the reader does 50% of the work, right? So you're meeting the artist in exact equality. The artist isn't trying to sort of be in a position higher than you in any way, right? They're not imposing the art on you. You're actually creating it as you're reading, which I find so profoundly moving and wonderful. It also means that as a writer, I'm writing to my readers on an equal basis. They are my absolute equals. They're helping me finish this book. And I love that, right? Because I do sometimes feel as a, when I'm sitting at a play, I'm being spoken at sometimes, or I'm looking at art in the Tate Modern, and I'm trying to figure out what emotional effect it's supposed to have on me. I feel like spoken to and not invited in sometimes, right? So I do think books are uniquely democratic.
I saw a painting today. We had a look around the Tate Britain, and it's a painting I've seen there before, and I've recognised, and it's enormous. And I'm not going to remember what it's called or who it's by, and I wish I did. But it's really, really dark, but there are these spots of light and sort of very pale pink among the green. And there's a sort of swamp effect, but you can see flowers, and there's a sort of sense of the light shifting. And I really love it, and I find it really beautiful and moving in a way I can't quite articulate. And when I thought, what is that? And I looked, and I think it was inspired by Friday the 13th or The Omen, or like a proper, but yeah, a horror film. And I'm not a big watcher of horror. Are you? Because there's so much horror in your, you know, that the sort of the alienation and the loneliness of the landscape closing in.
Yeah.
And you, I think you create that horror so vividly. Do you read much horror?
No. I think I have something that's, I think I heard it described as emotional synesthesia. So like, if I'm watching a horror movie, I'm actually feeling like these terrible things are happening to my body. And if I'm reading a horror book, I'm feeling them in my actual body. And I can't bear it. I've never been able to watch a horror film in my life.
Yeah, I cannot watch Wile E. Coyote fall off a cliff without feeling it. And it's briefly like stinging nettles.
Yes.
It's electricity.
I feel that too. That's we must have the same thing. My younger son also has it too. None of us can actually sit in a room when something scary is happening. Yeah. I have to do push-ups just to stay in tense situations sometimes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I do wonder how many authors feel that way. There's a writer I really love called Catherine May, who wrote a book called Wintering. I don't know if you've ever...
I've definitely heard of it, yeah.
..come across her. She writes about, I guess, sort of different kinds of neurodiversity. Mm. And she wrote a book called The Electricity of Every Living Thing, but it's about a sort of extreme stimulation and sensitivity and seeking quiet and seeking things that restore her, but also having to make peace with the fact that she's got to live in a world where that's not always going to be available to her. But she's a really kind of clear but lyrical writer. And
need to find that book too.
Like I said, it's a really beautiful new edition of it, actually.
It's
got a really gorgeous cover. But yeah, how many of us are here reading and writing because we, you know, voices and, you know, cartoon characters falling off cliffs, like the world is too much.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I definitely do have OCD. It's just, you know, part of my neuro makeup. And I do think part of reading and writing is the control factor. I mean, you can control for what's going on in the world in front of you, right? Even if it's in a book, you can put the book down if it's too much, if it's overload, like a sensory overload. Yeah.
I read a New York Times profile of you, which I loved. And there was a detail that stuck in my head about you writing different books concurrently, which I thought was sort of amazing. And to be able to move between those worlds and those spaces. And is that something that you've always done? I wonder if it's one of those things that sort of split writers in two, where some be like, oh gosh, I could never do that. But I thought, oh, it sounds really appealing, because you do, it gets so immersive and so intense, and you do need to go and be in another world for a while.
Yeah, I think it's mostly helpful when I'm having a hard time with a specific narrative. I can always go to the one that's actually calling to me, that's feeling urgent, that has some heat to it, you know. But in truth, I do it because I quote, waste a lot of my work. I mean, I write in drafts that I never reread. I put them in a box and then I start over again. And so it's a way of always feeling as though there's something that I will be able to finish. It may not be the thing that is most urgent to me now, but I'm definitely working on it, right? And I have my fingers in it and I'm thinking of it. And the most important thing is that it's sort of brewing in the subconscious. And it's the subconscious that does the most of the work, right? It's the subconscious that's the one set to dreaming through the whole scope of the novel before the novel is written.
I think that comes back to reading, doesn't it? That place in the brain that's just a bit more lucid, not trying to sort of force anything through.
I do think so too. I wish we had a neuroscientist here to tell us exactly what's going on.
Oh, what would be brilliant is if I could do a special series, because I'm actually, it's all very much to be announced, but I'm working on a nonfiction book that is about, I suppose, the emotions of reading and exactly what you were saying, that books are what I've always reached for to feel better. But also, I think that now more than ever, people are a little bit frightened of books, and that fear of sort of not having the time, and there are so many demands on us. And I do believe that there are some of the people who need books the most might be reading the least, and how to...
Really?
In the way that I think that until, you know, relatively recently, the idea that of exercising and moving your body because it felt good and not because it was going to make you thin or because the doctor had told you to or whatever, that's sort of relatively novel. I'm like, I wish we could do the same for books.
I'm sure you're right. I think it's, I think you're right. I think people are intimidated. Maybe they're not scared, but they are intimidated by the idea of not finishing a book. There are easier modes of engaging or disengaging from the world, right? I mean, watching Netflix is much easier. You just cue something up and then you push the button.
Have there been any books over your reading career that have sort of intimidated you, or anything you've started and not been able to stick with? And also, I also love to ask, are there any books that you haven't loved and haven't wanted to finish and then you've come back to? And
so many. Yeah, so the most recent example is Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman. It's an amazing book. It's Russian, about World War II, and it's sort of a constellation structure. So it takes a very long time to understand what is even going on, how the characters are related. But you just sort of eventually surrender to the book itself. It's vast also. I think it's like 1,200 pages. It's an enormous tome. And I tried to read it for a while and I just couldn't get into it. Absolutely love this book. It's so good. And then the other one was Don Quixote, but it's because I kept getting stuck in the beginning. I don't know if you remember, but there are these awful poems in the beginning of Don Quixote. They're just like egregiously awful.
I've never read it, and I think that might be why. I should read this. Everyone says it's great, though.
It's so funny. It's so wonderful. And it's he's doing metafictional techniques that you don't see again for another 300, 400 years. It's really an astonishing book. And you just have to, again, let it wash over you, right? Like Moby Dick is just a book just to let it wash over you. I love the big doorstoppers that you can get lost in and wander around, and that have just wonky structures. They're just monsters, like chimeras, like put together from the head of a unicorn and like the body of a lion, right? Like, there's no rhyme or reason to them, and yet they hang together because it's this one single voice, a brilliant person just smashing it all together. I love those things. I think it's great.
I would love to make a whole podcast mini series with you called something like, you can skip this part, and we take the classics and we say, okay, go from here.
Okay, I would love to do that. That'd be great.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We'll be back to Lauren soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Big Swiss by Jen Began. This is a very funny, very dark story about romantic obsession and death. Greta's house and life are already falling down when things become even more shambolic, as she falls hard for the woman whose sex therapy tapes she has been hired to transcribe. This story has it all. Sex, drugs, violence, dog, hipsters, and a bee infestation. I loved it. Big Swiss is published by Faber and out now. Now back to Lauren.
I think Moby Dick is definitely a book that I think a lot of us were made to read at some point. I think that's such a challenge as well, isn't it? When we're told this is canon and you have to love this, and that feeling like, you know, this book is smart and if you don't love it, you're dumb. I think really felt that at school with Thomas Hardy.
Oh God, Thomas Hardy. Yeah, yeah.
I was not living my best life with that guy.
I love Moby Dick so much. I do think it's joyous and funny, so much funnier than it gets. And it gives you, as a writer, it gives you license to do anything, because he does just anything and it works. I liked reading it this time. So I read it most recently with my friends as a, it's kind of a microcosm of America. And it's a criticism of America, particularly at the time that he wrote it, which is just before the Civil War. He's in search of whiteness, the monstrous whiteness. And the monstrous whiteness has obviously infected my entire country from the beginning. So it is probably the most critical, political, classic American book that exists on the planet. And I was not ready to see that when I read it before at 23 years old.
It's a very terrifying thing, I think, to contemplate the true loss of innocence when you really, really realise the people that are in charge have made a mess. There's not, I think there's a loss of hope there, and also that it's liberating and terrifying to think, oh, I suppose it's on us. At the moment, which contemporary writers do you think are doing that work?
Oh, I was so excited when Jon Fosse won the Nobel. I love him so much. I don't know if you've read Septology. It's, again, a giant doorstopper. It's a single sentence, seven books all in one. But it's one of the most extraordinary books I've ever read. It's like an ecstatic prayer. And I cried like 15 times when I read it. It's the closest I've come to a contemporary writer making a mystical experience happen inside my head.
Oh, wow.
It's really
It's an ayahuasca book.
It is an ayahuasca book. It's like, he's like, God. I see God through Jon Fosse.
Now, a book I loved that I was really, really scared of is Duck's Newburyport by Lucy Ellman, which is a single sentence in a mere 1,000 pages. So I feel like that was my training. I might be ready for Septology.
It's a very strange book. So you, it takes a while to get over your own resistance to the cyclical nature of the structure. But as soon as you just, I guess, succumb and surrender, it washes over you like waves. It's really beautiful.
I guess there are parallels as well there with kind of non-figurative art and the way our brains are so desperate to make sense of things, and that panic we feel, and how to trust that part of our brains that we're talking about that's sort of absorbing, and it's more conscious than anything, but it's not perhaps conscious in a way that we recognize. It's not working in a linear way. That reminds me of something, and I might be completely wrong. Is it in On Beauty by Zadie Smith where that comes up a lot, sort of?
I don't know. I don't remember that book very
clearly. Yeah, I just remember really enjoying it.
Me too. I always enjoy her voice. She's so brilliant.
I think I saw you mentioning NW in a
I love list that of book. I think books. That's her best book, but I don't know. Nobody else seems to think that.
I really want to go back to it. And reading that, and again, I thought, I do remember really enjoying this. You know, loving being
in the book, and I think because I love her essays so much, and nonfiction.
She's just she's got one of those George Eliot voices to bring it back to the beginning, right? Yeah. She's like a honeyed wisdom that you want to swim in. It's really very. She's very wise. She's very like she has like a kind of omniscience even in her essays that are first person that is really unusual. Like she's able to make these leaps that I think are balletic and very. Her mind is a beautiful thing to watch, I think.
There's a wisdom and a calmness, and it is as though she creates a very big space for us all to wander in, mm-hmm. and she doesn't really mind where we stop. She's never driving at one point and saying, this is it and you are here.
That's true, and I love that. There's an openness, a radical openness, right? She doesn't finish any of the essays with like a... this is what everyone should believe, which I think a lot of contemporary writers do to the detriment of thinking, right? I think to make an argument, oftentimes they close the argument off, but she does not ever do that. And I really admire her for that. That's probably harder.
Yeah, it feels especially courageous now.
I would agree. Yes.
And another book that I've never read and I keep trying to read and get thrown off as Infinite Jest, and it's because of her that I want to keep trying.
Can I tell you, we were talking about this book in the car over here, and I read Infinite Jest on my spring break senior year of university. That's how big a nerd I was. So when my friends were out, you know, partying, and I was by the pool reading this massive
imagining the setup and like, woo, MTV is in Boca Raton and you're there.
Yeah, I was sitting there like with the book and my sunglasses and large hat. Yeah, it was very nerdy. It was the most nerdy thing.
And are you glad you did
so it? So happy. Because every time I look at that book now, I think of sunlight and Mexican food and, you know, my friends understanding that I'm a jerk and that I'm not going to go out partying.
It sounds like you read in all formats, non-audiobook. As well.
I love audiobooks.
And I wanted to ask, you had any favorite narrators or books that you feel as though you've enjoyed especially because of hearing them?
I'm sure. What's her name? Julia Whelan does an amazing job every time she
does. She's fabulous, isn't she? And have you read her novels?
I've not yet, even though I know her and she did Fates and Furies. I know.
Please tell her I'm a massive fan.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because I know she did a book I love, really good actually, by Monica Heisey, which I think she did in a sort of fabulous and funny way. And I've not read The Oxford Year, and there's a second novel that she wrote, and it's really meta, and it's about, it's a rom-com about actors who do romance audiobooks.
Wow.
And it's really smart and really, really fun, and it's got so many layers to it. And it's one of those books, it's so... so charming and so knowing. And
good.
It does that gorgeous kind of Emily Henry thing of saying, I know you know what the rhythms and the beat of the story is going to be. Let's just enjoy it together.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And really have fun with it.
I can't wait to read it. I should read it. I feel really bad now.
Thanks for listening, I think it's called. Well, thank you.
Thanks
for listening.
Thank you for listening. I will look it up. They probably have it here in this bookstore.
I'm sure they have it here. It's so fun to be in a bookstore. Do you have any favorite bookstores?
There's so many favorite bookstores. Yeah, absolutely. I in the U.S., I love Books and Books in Coral Gables, which is in Miami. I love McNally Jackson in New York. There are too many to name, but here I really like Daunt Books a lot.
Daunt's so lovely.
Yes, Daunt's so lovely.
I love McNally Jackson too. I've not been in New York in a long time, but I've been there before. And my favorite thing to do is to sort of spend an embarrassing amount of money on a shiny, lovely book that I bought this book. It was a hardback and it was expensive. And it had a sort of very Hockney-esque cover and it was all like 70s, like swimming pools in somewhere in sort of Southern California. And I think it was quite a serious, an academic book about kind of Playboy and pop pornography. And like, where did that book go? But I remember going to Café Gitane afterwards and having my avocado toast like a great big tourist and thinking, this is my holiday. This is a treat.
That's what everywhere I go to the bookstore first. We were just in Lisbon and I went to I can't remember the name of it. Can you remember?
Oh.
That incredible bookstore. That's just, it's in that old warehouse.
Oh, and sorry, I'm thinking of a different bookstore in a different place in Portugal. So no, I don't think I know.
Are you thinking of that really gorgeous one? Like the most beautiful bookstore
in the world? The one in
Porto. Yes,
yeah, that
you
I think
are.
Has
yeah.
a sort of, yeah. now has a turnstile. And I think that please don't come in and just, you know, put this on TikTok and
oh,
don't
really?
Buy a book.
And to come in, you must buy a book. That's the entry fee. Yeah. That's so fun. No, I don't have a favorite. They're all my favorite.
that's the best answer. Have you been to Ann Patchett's? And
yeah, I was just there actually. Yeah, and I love her. I love the dogs. She always brings the dogs. And you at one point for Matrix, I got to sit with a dog on my lap as Anne interviewed me
wow.
with a dog on her lap, which was the most joyous thing of all times.
Amazing.
If I had a bookstore, it'd be dog friendly for sure.
I have Zoomed with Sparky.
You
have
Zoomed with Sparky.
It's very exciting. Dave, my friend, the writer Nina Stibbe, who's really great and really funny, took a screenshot of just sort of on one side it was Sparky and on the other side it was just my face doing a sort of Macaulay Culkin-esque like,
I met a dog last night in Manchester. What was his name? Buzz. And he did part of my interview last night. It was really lovely. Buzz the Pomeranian.
Wow, did Buzz have great questions? They're better than my questions.
Well, no, he had no questions. It was a very difficult interview.
No
a lot of snarling and growling.
Amazing. You have dogs, right?
I have one dog. Her name is Olive, and she's the best. She's a Labradoodle. She's very chill now. She's 8. They're a mess early on.
Do you ever talk through books with Olive?
Oh,
when you're
I do.
Out walking? Is that how you think through?
Oh, she hates it. So I actually, often when I can't write, I will read. And sometimes I read poetry. And of course, you have to read poetry out loud. And you can't just read it out loud to the air. You have to read it to the only animate creature in the room, which is Olive. And so I look at Olive and I read poetry to her. And she gets up very gently and leaves the room. I follow her through the house.
You're not reading her those poems from Don Quixote, are you?
No, God, never. No. But, you know, a little Emily Dickinson goes a long way to a dog.
Other than Emily Dickinson, who do you read? I often think I always, always say this. Like, poetry. I love poetry. Why do I read it so rarely?
Yeah, I like to read it often just because they're small books that really give you tools for your own work. So Kaveh Akbar is really great. He has a new novel coming out called Martyr. It's amazing. It's so good. It's coming out in January. Ada Limón, who's our new poet laureate in the U.S. She's not strictly a poet, even though I think she is. But Emily Wilson, who did the new Iliad and she did the Odyssey, she's unbelievable. When it comes to her ear, nobody's better than Emily. And she's doing translation at the same time. I don't even know how she does it. She's genius. It's incredible. There are a lot of people. I love a lot of poetry.
Oh, there are some fabulous recommendations there. I'm so fascinated by translators as well. Mm-hmm. I met an author at the weekend. He's writing a book about Shakespeare in translation.
Ooh.
In different places.
Oh, that's interesting.
And because I wanted to know whether there were any countries that were kind of, who has Shakespeare sort of the most relatively recently.
Yeah.
And you're saying what does tend to happen is everyone does the biggie straight away and you'll have sort of, you know, 5 Romeo and Juliets knocking about and 10 Hamlets, but people are slow to do kind of, you know,
Troilus
and Richard III part 2.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The tricky
yeah.
history.
Yeah. I mean, I've read all of, in order to write Pastor, I read all of Shakespeare, and there are, some, it gave me a lot of heart that even Shakespeare could write a bad play. There's some pretty bad plays there, too. I know it sounds terrible to say, but Pericles, quite bad.
Because I vaguely remember, and I might have this wrong, because I think I only read Pericles because I was assigned it. I'm not sure I would have got to it. But I do remember, is there a lot of Pericles that kind of became The Tempest?
I don't know.
I feel like it's about a man and his daughter in a drowning or a shipwrecking. Or,
I hated
is
it so much.
Is that very violent?
I don't even remember. I'll be honest. I put it out of my mind.
I love this idea. And I love it with contemporary writers as well. But when you see and you read early work and you're like, oh, you're working through this.
Right.
That's the genesis of something.
Right.
I love Catherine Heine and her
I think her short story collection, Single Carefree Mellow, came out first. Huh. And you can sort of see that in her novels. And it's like notes and outlines of things that are going to become bigger. And
I think, I like to to be a completist for writers because I like to trace their development over time. Like, I think someone who is really interesting that way is Rachel Cusk. Mm. Because the way she had that immense like earthquake halfway through and decided to do the outline style. And that's what she's doing now. And she's sort of, it's kind of astonishing what she did because she's a great writer now. She was a great writer before when she was doing more plot driven stuff. I think it's fascinating.
Really fascinating. Yeah. And I think really encouraging as well. I love the idea that we can all just throw it all out the window and do something completely, completely dramatically unexpected, make a real departure.
Right? We all should probably at one point have a midlife crisis, go off in the autofiction area.
Right, space operas and westerns.
Which is operas. I would do that in a heartbeat.
I feel like your work is made for opera. I think that would be
incredible.
Thank
you for saying that. I actually wrote Fates and Furies as an opera, as a novel opera. I would love for it to be an opera. I tried to approach a couple of opera composers and they didn't want anything to do with it, but I would love for that to happen.
Well, I mean, we must have someone listening who can compose an opera because they're just so lush and so dramatic and so, you know, for the stage.
I grew up in Cooperstown, New York, which has nothing in it, but it does have an amazing opera house. And every summer it's for young artists. They come and they do their first major roles, their first, you know, Queen of the Nights here at this relatively small country opera house that only seats, I want to say, 1,000 people. But the productions are incredible. And then when you are a kid who lived in town, you could just get tickets for no money at all. I went to like 5 operas a year when I was like a little kid. And, you know, it'd be one was like, of course, like musicals, but Pirates of Penzance is a light opera, right? And then all the way through to really intense, very strange modern things that I didn't understand at all. So it was extraordinary. And that went deep into my work for sure.
You go because it's on. And I've heard people who make movies, you talk about growing up and, you know, all there was to do was like there was a very small movie that sort of just show the same 2 films over and over again for a month and you know, and not new films and just what they could, and that those are now the, you know, are great directors because they
you
know, they fell into an obsession.
There's something about being screamed at by a person with incredible vocal power that really can like drill a narrative into you. It was foundational to my artistic life for sure.
Is the opera house still there?
Yeah, it's called Glimmer Glass. It's spectacular. It's my favorite place.
I love that so much because I think especially here, you know, I think, oh, how wouldn't it be lovely to go to the opera? And I think that because I've seen a couple and loved them and not sort of gone with friends, not really know where to begin. Yeah. But there are so many barriers, I think, but, you know, in London and it's sort of, you know, sort of expensive money and time. And you do think, I'd need to plan it and know it. And I love the idea of maybe I'll, you know, go and stay up there for a summer and just see. It's probably cheaper than going to the A&O.
Yes, it's very cheap.
Even including like your flight.
Your flight, exactly. Or you could go to Berlin, which has, I want to say, 4 opera houses, and they are so inexpensive. I was just in Berlin for 6 months. They're so cheap. You have a selection of 5 or 6 operas you could go to every single week. It's really amazing. And it's so thrilling, too, because they don't just do the standards. They also sort of branch out and do some crazy stuff. It's really exciting.
Oh, that would be really, really fun.
Just go to Berlin for the week.
How was Berlin? Were you there? Writing or teaching? Or
I was at the American Academy in Berlin, so I just had to give one lecture and then listen to my other fellows give lectures. It was so wonderful. Well, I live in Gainesville, Florida, a disastrous place right now because of all the banned books and the really severe political climate and everything. So getting away to Berlin to like a real cosmopolitan artistic place was so wonderful. It's heaven.
I always just think of kind of Christopher Isherwood still, and obviously, you know, that's a snapshot of a small a place in a moment. And even when things weren't free, you could be very free there.
Yes.
If you found a way and you had to look.
Oh, I love, you know, the Germans, the attitudes are so beautiful and kind of soft. Like, this is not what we are trained to think of when it comes to German people. But, you know, everywhere you go in the summer, there are these lakes where people just strip off all their clothes and go swimming and come out. And the mere fact that there's nudity everywhere makes it not sexual whatsoever. And it's just really like there's a climate of acceptance and like tolerance that was very strange coming from the American South, which has no tolerance whatsoever for any sort of
and behavior. I imagine so many weird sort of ornate rules that no one actually spells out.
Yes, you do not perspire as a woman, and that's really hard if you're in Florida. Yes, there are many things that happen in civilized drawing rooms in the South that are really arcane and ornate.
Going back to banned books in this terrifying time, it's so alarming for children and adults never not being able to celebrate literature. Practically speaking, is there anything that you think a person can do?
Well, I do. I think there are many things that a person can do. So I don't know if you know this, but the vast majority of the challenges to the books are come from 11 individuals. So it is an example of a very tiny minority ruling over the rights of the vast majority of people. So some of the things we can do are some states have actually adopted a no book banning rule. I mean, we could do that now. Will we do that? No, it's Florida. We're already lost. But what individuals can do is make these books available in any way they possibly can. And that could be a free library on their lawn. It could be donating these books to an organization that disseminates them to children, right? There are a lot of things we can do, and a lot of people are actually pushing back. Today, I found out this bookshop.org. I don't know if you have it here.
We do.
Okay, lovely. They have, in Florida, a banned book store, so any Floridian can get for free a banned book. So even people who don't necessarily need the financial wherewithal, you know, money to do it, can get a banned book and then give it to whoever they want to. It's really an astonishing thing. And it's funded by well-meaning people, billionaire someone somewhere.
Oh, thank goodness, finally a well-meaning billionaire.
At least we have one.
Yeah. That's really, really heartening,
yeah,
I think.
It's good.
And
it's
that's good. What I love so much about these conversations is I think, you know, it will prevail and we will prevail.
Yeah.
This is how we communicate and explore and share ideas.
I just read
a book. Oh, I don't think I've quite finished it yet because it's got a little bit kind of, it's diaries. Called, I think it's called I Could Not Believe It, the Teenage Diaries of Shaun Delier. Have you come across that?
No.
It's about being a queer teenager in Southern California and Los Angeles in the 70s. And I don't want to misgender Sean, who I think, I'm not sure what their pronouns were when they died, and they died quite young. But as in the diaries and in the book, Sean, I think at that point used he. But yeah, it's, and admittedly, he talks about just how important books and bookstores were. A lot of it was like straight up porn, like filth all the way. But the, at that time, the freedom to be a queer teenager. I mean, I love it as well because, don't get me wrong, I love an introspective queer teenage book that talks about, you know, the challenges and the sort of, you know, the things in kind of Jeanette Winterson territory.
Yeah, yeah.
But Shaun Delier is having a lovely time. And yeah, just sort of getting the bus and like picking up guys and going to glory holes and reading. But it's a lot of it when he's when they're not in a glory hole, in a bookshop always. are there any books on your pile that you're really excited about reading or anything you're looking forward to over the coming months?
Oh, there's so many. I am halfway through Kairos by Jenny Urbanbeck.
And I had to leave it because I didn't want to lose it in a hotel room because I've been on the road for a month at this point and I'm so tired. I'm halfway through Libra by Don DeLillo and it's not my favorite DeLillo. Oh. It's okay. It's fine. It has a really good beginning and then the rest of it is a little, you know, snoozy.
But I love that even Don DeLillo can, you know, not... Well, favorite writers can't write our favorite books every time. I find that very heartening.
It's very wonderful, right? I mean, I will give him every single chance because of Underworld and because of, White Noise, right? I mean, yeah. What else? I don't even know. What are you interested in? What are you excited for?
Well, again, like you, I had, and I think it's so lovely when you're away for a little while and you think, I really want to bring this book with me. But when I return, I'm so looking forward to getting back into it. Mm-hmm. So I'm finally in the middle of Big Swiss by Jen Biegun.
Oh, so fun. Isn't that a fun book?
I just, I love the wit of it. Again, in a weird way, I think there are some parallels with Vaster Wilds in terms of this, the outdoors and how the outdoors gets indoors. And when she's talking about the, you know, this beautiful crumbling house she's living in, and like the window, the glass falling out the window panes and stuff.
Have you gotten to the point where there are the bees in the ceiling?
Yes.
Yeah, and the honey dripping down. It's an amazing. Yeah, I really enjoyed that book a lot. I listened to that on audiobook.
Pat, thank you so much. That was
my pleasure.
So much fun.
Yeah,
really,
I had a really,
really
fun
enjoyed it.
This is my favorite kind of conversation is the book conversation.
Okay.
And just talking about books for an hour. It's marvelous.
Huge thanks to Lauren. The Vaster Wilds is published by Cornerstone and out now. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and created by Dale Shaw and me, Daisy Buchanan. To see all the books Lauren mentioned, go to acast.com/booked, and you can shop a selection on our page at bookshop.org. Find us and follow us on social media at @ybooked, and if you're feeling especially generous, we would hugely appreciate a 5-star review. As well as helping us, you could be helping a new listener discover the podcast and find their new favourite book. For now, I leave you with this from Stephen Sondheim. It takes almost as much imagination to justify what you write as it does to write it. See you next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.